of Dalet, Amud Aleph. That's where we left off last time. And we're up to the Gemara of Rabbi Zeira. We touched on it last time. Let's go over it one more time. And you'll see this about 12 lines down from the top of the page, a little bit between Tosus Omar and Tosus Viaf. And the Gemara quotes a statement of Rabbi Zeira, which is taken from the Gemara in Ksuvis. In the case where you find a piece of meat in a city that has 9 kosher butcher shops and 1 non-kosher butcher shop, Omar Rabbi Zeira afal pi shedalsos medina neulos. It means we don't have any meat coming in from the outside. Had we have meat coming in from the outside, then we could construct 2 rows, if you recall. That's called Trey Ruby. We have most of the meat in the city that's kosher, and most of the meat that's coming into the city from outside the city is kosher. And that gives you a double row. Says Rabbi Zeira, it's not necessary. Even in a situation where the gates of the city are locked, and therefore there's no possibility of meat coming in from the outside, so you're left with only 1 robe, that's sufficient. The Torah says, let's rely on a robe. Achrei rabim lahatos. 1 robe is sufficient. And we get back now to our case of dam hanimtza beprozdor. And if you recall, a woman found dam and it was not clear whether the dam came from the cheder and it's tomei, or from the aliyah and it's tahar. And we constructed a rove based on the fact that most of the volume of dam comes from the cheder, and therefore we established and we declared her as a tmeya. That's a case of dalsos medina neulos, meaning we only have 1 rove, namely the rove dam that comes from the cheder. We don't have any other source of dam. So in deciding between the cheder and the aliyah, we can only activate 1 rove. Nevertheless, she becomes tmeya. Afilu Hachi, the Gemara says, Kazlin and Basaruba, we follow the rove. So therefore we see that 1 rove is enough. And Rabbi Zeira's principle has been accepted. And that's why Daman Imtzu opposed to the Bryson of Rabbi Chia establishes that she's a Vade Tmeya based on 1 rove. There's no need to add a 2nd rove. So the Gemara asks the following question. Wasn't it Rava himself who's now apparently deriving that Rov is sufficient, but Rava himself was the one who stated that we need more than just Rov, we needed a Rov and a Matsui. And you could, you know, for those of you who were with me in the past, you'll know what I'm talking about Rov and Matsui. And the Gemara now has to establish that Rav himself changed his opinion, and he believes that Matsui doesn't really add anything to the Rov, and the situation with Matsui or Rov without Matsui is absolutely identical. Now, the only thing I want to add to what we discussed last time is that this halach of Trey Ruby, which again the Gemara is rejecting now, but there was an opinion back in Ksuvis that you need Trey Ruby. So you may recall the case in Ksuvis in the Mishnah was a case of a woman, Nebuchadnezzar, a Jewish girl, was raped, and we're not sure if the rapist was such that he was a non-Jew, and therefore he disqualifies her forevermore to marry a Kohen, or maybe the rapist was a Jew and she can marry a Kohen. So in that scenario, the Gemara insisted, according to one opinion, that we need Trey Ruby. We have to have most of the people in the city Jewish, and we have to have an influx of people from outside the city that are Jewish in order to construct a double rove. If you look carefully in that sugya, you'll certainly conclude that the requirement of Trey Ruby of 2 roves, according to that Manti Omar, again, we pass like Reb Zera that 1 rove is enough, but according to that opinion, when you need Trey Ruby, that's not what we call a Doraisa halacha. That's not a Torah requirement. It's the Rabbanan, who didn't want to rely on 1 rove, will explain why, who wanted to require a 2nd rove. The 2nd rove would solve a certain problem that could possibly exist if we rely on 1 rove. And I'll explain what that problem is and what motivated the Rabbanan to introduce the requirement and establish the requirement of a 2nd rove to to add to the first one. But what I want you to understand before we get into that is that it becomes clear from the sugya over there in Ksubas that even according to the Madiyot, it requires Trey Ruby. That's not a Doraisa halacha. That was an invention of the Chachamim to require a second Rove, not relying on the Rove within the city, but requiring a Rove of people coming in, an influx from outside the city. The Torah for sure never required more than one Rove. Why did the Rabbanim require a second Rove according to that opinion? Because one Rove, in a case of a Maisa Ones, of a woman who was raped, is a little bit iffy. What makes it iffy? Why is it less than completely reliable? And there the Gemara says that it depends exactly how this onus took place. There are two possible scenarios. One scenario is in which this woman was wherever she was, and the rapist came out, the Boel, we'll call him, came out of one of his places. We don't know if he came from a Jewish place or a non-Jewish place. We don't know if he's a Jew or not. But be that as it may, he came out, and he was Boel. In that case, we apply the rule of kol deparish miruvah parish, meaning when something leaves and we don't know where it left from, we can assume it came from the Rove. The majority rules. However, there's another possible scenario that might have happened. It could be in a different case than this one, but she went to him. You know, she was working and she went into his house, and there the rape took place. That's where the suffix is nola b'makom kvius, and we had long discussions about this, and therefore we apply kol kavua kemetzal mechzadami. Now, to avoid that possibility, we want to rely on the rove that's from outside the city. The rove from outside the city doesn't expose itself to the vulnerability of possibly being a kol kavua kemetzal mechzadami, meaning, in order to guarantee and assure that the halacha will allow her to marry a kohen based on a viable rove, and in order to be convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt that we're not dealing with a kavua situation, and somebody made a boo-boo here and mistakenly confused kavua with kol deparish, and he thought that what difference it make whether she was raped here or there, so we guarantee that problem will not exist by adding a second rove from the outside. And that's a rabbinic requirement.
So the problem is if the rove from inside the city could be biased?
One more time, but you have to speak a drop louder.
I said the problem is that the rove from inside of the city could be somewhat biased?
I'm not sure the last word you said was biased?
Yeah.
Well, okay, I'm not sure what you mean by biased. I would say it could be unreliable, if that's what you mean. And what would make it unreliable? Because it wasn't that the boil came to her, rather she went to him.
Right.
I don't mean to say, I'm not trying to say anything pejorative about her, that she went to him for that purpose. That wasn't my intention. What I meant was that she went to him, entered into his house, she didn't have the proper protection and security measures, and it was a major mistake on her part. But whatever it is, if she goes into his house, the whole nature of rove changes. The rove is no longer reliable. So since we get into this whole issue of did she go to him or did he come to her, so the Rabbanim made a gzera that even though he came to her and it is a viable rove, but tomorrow they're going to confuse this with another scenario. They won't be sensitive to this distinction and to insist on the fact that it was a kol deparish rove. They may get confused and blur the distinctions between a kavua situation and a rove situation. That's why the Rabbanan instituted a requirement of a second rove, in order to avoid that. It's what we call a gzera derabbanan. You know that the Rabbanan are always making gzeros to avoid prohibitions and violations. But the bottom line is, when we come back to our Gemara, we don't have that same situation of a suffek, of some sort of confusion between rove and kavua. Her dam comes out of the body. We want to know where it came from. That's called the parsh meruva parsh. And we assume it came from the rove, which in this case is the cheder. So obviously, trey ruby would not be a requirement. One rove is sufficient.
In the case of the where you wanted the double authority, in that example that gave rise to the
rabbinic stipulation of requiring the second rov. What would be the case if you have a small community of majority non-Jewish, but a lot of transients coming in from outside who are Jewish, and you find a need? Would the argument then be that the single majority, by virtue of the outsiders coming in, is sufficient, and the local majority that goes in the wrong direction doesn't count, because by analogy with the case of maybe she went to him, that wouldn't apply if you're talking about transients coming from outside?
So, Lawrence, this issue about whether we use the local rov or the outside rov in a case where they're contradictory, that's this sugya that we learned called rov versus karov. Meaning, Karov claims, let's look at what's going on locally, and if most of the people local are non-Jewish, then she can never marry a Kohen. If, on the other hand, Rov beats out Karov, which is the Shita Rabbi Hanina, then we go bust a Rov against the Karov. We no longer limit ourselves to the circumscribed area, which is proximate, but rather we open ourselves to what we call Ruba d'Alma, as we discussed. And if the Ruba d'Alma now gives us the right to introduce a Rov that would permit her to marry a Kohen, we could do so.
Okay.
All right, we have to really analyze all the cases, but let's move on, and we're going to start a kind of like a new sugya within a sugya, and I hope I didn't lose anyone who wasn't with us until now, and I apologize for that. Itmar. So you'll see this again in the Gemara between Tosus V'af and Tosus D'Tani, if that's a good way of finding it. Itmar. We learned the following din. Chavis shetzafa binahar. We find a barrel of wine floating on the river. Do you remember this discussion that we had?
Yeah.
Let's just repeat some of the background information. On the one hand, the local city, which borders on this location where we found the wine, is Jewish. On the other hand, there are many other cities, let's call them to the north, that border on this river, and had a barrel come out of that, one of those cities, and flown down the river, then we would certainly assume that the wine came from a non-Jewish city, because all the cities bordering on this river, which is called Nahar Pras, are non-Jewish. Amar Rav, and this we saw last time, but again, I want to review it one more time. Nimtzeis keneged ir sheruba Yisrael mutar. In other words, all that we're concerned with is what we call Karov, the proximate city. We completely disregard the other cities because they're at a distance. So if the city that's proximate, in this case is a Jewish city, we're allowed to drink the wine because it's kosher wine. Keneged ir sheruba nachrim, if on the other hand, the barrel was found proximate to a non-Jewish city, then Asira. Everything depends upon proximate. Everything depends upon Karov. We're not going to apply the rule of Rov. Ushmuel Amar, Afilu Nimtzeis Keneged Ir Sheruba Yisrael, Asira. Shmuel says, forget about Karov. Let's look at the majority of the cities and their populations and what kind of wine is coming out of those cities. So that the rove, in the general sense, even outside the parameters of this particular area where you found the barrel, that will determine the halacha. And since rove in this case is nachrim, we're not allowed to drink the wine. So the machlok shin Rav and Shmuel revolves around a case where you find a barrel of wine outside a Jewish city, but most of the other cities in the northern part of this area are non-Jewish. So Rav permits you to drink the wine, and Shmuel does not. Amor, should we say? I'm sorry. Amor, mehai dikra asoi. Shmuel says, let's suggest that maybe it came from one of the other cities in the area. Fine. Lema, so the Gemara says, should we not say, b'Rabbi Hanina ka miflegi? That the issue at heart, at stake here, is Rabbi Hanina. Demar Islay de Rabbi Chanina Shmuel, who says that we rely on Rov, and Rov beats out Karov. So forget about the closest city. I'm interested in the majority of the cities. And since they're non-Jewish, the wine is awesome. Umar, but Rav, less late than Rabbi Chanina. Rav rejects Rabbi Chanina, and he holds like Rabbi Zera, as we saw earlier on Daf of Gimel Amid Beis, that Karov beats out Rov. And since Karov beats out Rov, and the closest city is Jewish, therefore we're allowed to drink the wine. Now, I don't think the Gemara is too happy about this, for a number of reasons, not the least of which, Rav is now rejecting Rabbi Chanina, and that's a tenuous position, because the Gemara, time after time, is trying to establish Rabbi Chanina as halacha. Rava before made an attempt at deriving Rabbi Chanina from Rabbi Chiya, and Rav is a major, major player. And in Machlok Shin Rav and Shmuel, we're going to pass him like Rav. So we're going to get stuck in all sorts of problems if Rav is rejecting Rabbi Chanina. And therefore the Gemara is going to make an attempt here to reconcile Rav with Rabbi Chanina. And the Gemara says as follows. Lo, dekuli alma isluhu de Rabbi Chanina. No, that's not the right shot. Everybody agrees to Rabbi Chanina. Certainly Rav beats out Karov. Ve'hacha be'hacha miflegi. What's Rav saying? Why is he arguing in favor of Karov? Demar Savar, because Rav holds in arguing with Shmuel's logic that maybe he came from the other cities. If the barrel would have rolled out of one of the northern cities, the non-Jewish cities, Akuli Upshuri Avi Mitbele, it never would have made it down the river. You may recall that we discussed in the past that any kind of rove has to have some feasibility, some level of probability. And in this particular case, we don't have, according to Rav's perception, any sort of likelihood that this barrel would have come from the rove. Why not? Because Akuli Upshuri Avi Mitbe'ele. What is the word Mitbe'ele? Litva, does anybody know what tvi? To drown, right? It would have sunk to the bottom. Somehow, on the way down the river, where you have these ikule upshure, these Rashi goes into long discussion, but suffice it to say, these are areas that will stop the, you know, that which is flowing down the river and basically catch it and incarcerate it there. What are the chances, says Rav, that any barrel coming from up north along this entire long river, major, you know, river, would make it down to the bottom? So you're introducing a rove, and in theory the rove exists, but it's really not, it's not feasible, it's not logical, it's not likely or probable that it would have come from the rove. Such a rove you can't construct. You can construct a rove, you have people coming from outside, that's fine. But to say that somebody could have made it through this trek, meaning a barrel of wine, could have made it down the river, that's unlikely. And therefore, Rav disqualifies the rove. Had it been a healthy rove, that rove, like Rabbi Chanina insists, would have trumped a Karov. And even Rav agrees to that. But now the question becomes, what do we do with Shmuel? Because did Shmuel not realize that this rove is very tenuous? That the chances of the barrel coming down the river are very, very unlikely. Umar Savar, the Gemara defending Shmuel, who applies the rove, Harifa Dinahara Nokat Viasoy. There is a possibility that the barrel, when it rolled out of the city, let's say at the docks, you know, and it hit the water, it hit the river. It did so in a particular location where there's a harifa de Nara. Nara is the river. And harifa means a great push. There was a push of water, you know, like a Niagara Falls, that grabbed hold of this barrel and gave it such a push down an area in which there are no ikuli upshure, and it actually made it down the bottom. And what we want to point out here is that it's very difficult to understand what's the nature of this machlok shin Rav and Shmuel. You know, Rav says, well, what are the chances? And it's not going to happen. It's unlikely the battle's going to make. Shmuel says, no, it's going to. I mean, what's it all about? And the thought occurred to me, I'm just, you're the jury out there. You can decide whether you like it or not. I can't force this upon you because it's just my own musings. That maybe Rav and Shmuel are arguing about the conceptual nature of Rov. It's a pure theoretical question. The Nafkamina is going to be this case of a barrel that may or may not have come down the river from the Rov, from the cities that are non-Jewish. But that's just a case in point. There's a fundamental issue at stake over here about how to construct a Rov. And it all depends on the nature of Rov. What is Rov? You know, any society and any science for that matter operates within a logical, intuitive system of statistical probability. You know, you go to college and you take statistics 1.1. I mean, statistics is not something that the Torah invented. It's part of the human race. We usually assume that the majority tells me what happened. That's called a birur. Bet yud resh vav resh. Birur means it in a sense gives us evidence. It points us in a certain direction. There's a probability theory. Well, if Rove is nothing more than a birur, it's some sort of statistical probability axis, then who's right in this machlok stream, Rav and Shmuel?
You have to know what is the sample from which you're deriving the majority. If you pick a different sample, you may well get different results.
Right, no, but Lawrence, I want you to focus just, maybe you are, but just in case you're not, in a Skype show, it's a little bit difficult. I don't know what exactly I'm able to convey, so I think I'm trying to be clear. Well, what I want you to focus on is Rav's argument against Shmuel is that it's improbable that a barrel of wine from one of the non-Jewish cities is going to float down the river and make it all the way down to the bottom. There are too many obstacles in its way, in its path. That's called Ikulei Pshure. What approach, what vision or perspective is Rav applying to Rov? And therefore he objects to this Rov in this case. Statistical probability. Who are you fooling, says Rav? You know, it's very unlikely that this would happen. And I'm assuming now again that Shmuel is not, he's not going to fight Rav about that. Shmuel's going to imagine a scenario which he himself would admit is a bit far-fetched. And that's why I insist that Shmuel must have come up with a different definition of Rov. He's not operating with Rov as a classical birur. He doesn't think that what we're learning here in the parsha of Rov is statistical probability.
The waterfalls and rapids, then they would be within the pool, within the sample of constructing a proper rov of which the one Jewish community is a part. On the other hand, if those communities that create this theoretical rov are upstream of the waterfalls and rapids, then you could conclude that anything coming from is going to be dashed by the rocks, and therefore you exclude them from the sample in constructing the rov.
Yeah.
Because the rapids and the waterfalls would take anything coming from that area out of the system.
Right. I agree with you, Lawrence. You know, in every case.
And that may be why the two rabbis have two different conclusions, because they're really talking about two different cases.
Right, okay, I agree with you that, you know, we can really get into this whole thing, what was the case and what were the chances of, but it seems to me that what Shmuel was doing is he was racking his brains and trying to figure out how it could be that the barrel came down. That's a little bit odd, you know, it's sort of like what we call pushing it. Meaning, Shmuel agrees to the reality. I mean, that's the way I was always taught to learn a Gemara, that, you know, they're not talking on two different levels or addressing two different realities. Shmuel and Rav would both agree that every situation has to be judged unto itself, and certainly Rav in many cases would admit that, you know, there are rapids going this way, and like, and a Shmuel would agree on the other end that in certain situations it's really impossible to imagine that it came from upstream. But the methodology that I applied to learning a piece of Talmud, and that's what I was taught by my Rebbeim, is that we assume they're both talking to each other on the same scenario, the same case. And Rav's point is it's unlikely that it came from the Rove. Shmuel is saying, b'chol zot, let's push it in. Let's imagine that it could have happened. And Rav would say to him, yeah, you know, Shmuel, you're right, it could have happened. Maybe, you know, there was a point in which there was a charifus de nahar, but, you know, why are you coming up with way out theories in order to salvage the rove? So what I thought was that if we work with the premise, which again, you know, I'm not forcing you to buy into this, but that's the way I was taught, that they don't argue about the reality of the situation. They both agree it's really a bit of a push. It's unlikely that Rav's approach is that Rove has to really convince me, it has to serve as some sort of evidence that this really happened. After all, it came from the Rove. Says Rav, in this case, Rove doesn't convince me. It really doesn't do it for me. Because to say that just because there are so many cities up there and they're massively populated by non-Jews, that doesn't tell me anything about this barrel, because who are you fooling? What are the chances the barrel came down? That's why I thought that maybe Shmuel, by saying b'chol zot, you know, insisting in any event that maybe the barrel came down, maybe he's operating with a different definition of rov. And you remember we spoke about the Rashash, about the triangular piece of meat and the rectangular piece of meat? And you may recall that the Rashash insisted that even though you found, shall we say, I don't remember the exact structure there, the scenario, but you found the triangular piece of meat, and it's the goyim who cut it in a triangle, nevertheless, you're allowed to eat it. I mean, obviously, the Rashash is not applying any sort of a statistical rove over here, because statistically, it's likely that this piece of meat is not kosher because it's triangular. You know, imagine if you had a city where the goyim, you know, put a red stripe on their meat, you know. So I don't care if there are 50,000 kosher butcher stops, but you found a piece of meat with a red stripe on it. Doesn't that tell you something? And the Rashash says, nein, it doesn't matter, it's still rov. And therefore the Rashash says that the 51st member of this, you know, Jewish member of this city, if he's a Kohen and he wants to marry her, and he knows that he wasn't the Boel, so from his perspective it's 50-50, says the Rashash, he's allowed to marry her. It means that Rove is operating with a whole different, fundamentally different set of principles. That's why I suggest that the Rashash's view of Rove, which again has generated a tremendous amount of controversy, because you eat the piece of meat that's triangular, I'm not going to eat it, you know what I mean? That approach might find a reflection in the Sheet of Shmuel. Again, the Rashash is probably, you know, I can almost hear him screaming in my ear, you know, no, I work out even according to Rav, you know, but I'm going to say that the Rashash really reflects Shmuel's approach to Rove. Shmuel says, look, Rav, you know, you've absolutely convinced me. I can't fight with you. The chances of the barrel successfully coming down all the way down here is a bit of a stretch. I admit it. But b'chol zot, it's a rov. Meaning, Shmuel is coming to the table with a different kind of perception of what rov is all about. It's not statistics. Rov is something which is not derived from human logic in a halachic sense. It's derived from a verse in the scriptures, from a doraisa, from a pasuk, achrei rav lahatas. The Torah, therefore, has its own definition of rov, which doesn't necessarily have to reflect the human concept of rov, because the Torah works within a halachic, we'll call it a juridic framework, its own principles, with its own inner logic and its own mechanism. It may or may not reflect what to you and I is intuitive, universal logic. So we're not talking about statistics according to Shmuel. We're talking about what we call a din. A din means This is the way the halacha operates. And I give you an example. You remember the sugya of Egla Rufa, where you found a dead body outside the city. And guess what? The Gemara says in Sota, that city does not bring an Egla Rufa. The next city over will bring an Egla Rufa. Why? What's the difference between the closed city and the next city? The Gemara says in Sota, because the closed city does not have a Beit Din. The next city has a Beit Din. And the Torah says that the closest city that has a Beit Din will bring the Egla Rufa. Once again, we're not dealing with human logic over here. When you say that you want to figure out where the Rotzeach came from, and the Torah itself says it came from the closest city, and now all of a sudden you're skipping over the closest city, you're going to the next city, which may be 50 miles down the road, but it's the first city with a Beit Din. Something's a little bit odd over here, no? You're not working with human logic. The Torah is saying, Karov, yes, but on the condition that it has a Beit Din. And the city with the Beit Din has the responsibility to bring the Egla Rufa, go through the whole process and the ritual of declaring, Yodeinu lo shofkas adam azev, einenu lo ro. But the city with a Beit Din, now, again, statistically, where did the Rotzeach come from? You know, the Torah itself is saying it came from the closest city. But it doesn't have a Beit Din. So therefore it came from the next city over? How do you understand that? Obviously, the Torah is working within a framework of what I call Din. You know, I use that term Din. Dalet Yud Nun, or D-I-N. I don't know how you spell it. Din means, you know, and there are, you know, there are many, many examples of Din. Okay, let's go on, if it's okay with you. Hahu chatzva de chamra. Okay? What's a chatzva de chamra? Well, chamra is wine. Chatzva, if you take a look in Rashi, okay, I don't find it right now, but I think, if I'm not mistaken, a chatzva is a flask of wine. I mean, chamra means wine. Dishtakich, and where did you find it? Bipardisa di Arla. You found it in a vineyard, and that vineyard was consisted of grapes that were Arla. Do you remember what Arla is? The first 3 years that the tree produces is called Arla. Now, if you found this flask of wine in an orchard or a vineyard of Arla, then what would you assume is the status of that wine? You know, that grape juice that was squeezed from these grapes. It should be what? Arla, correct? Arla you're not allowed to eat?
Why would you assume that?
David, can you speak a drop louder?
I just said, why would you assume that?
Well, there's a halach of Karov. Karov tells me that if you cannot identify something, you assume it came from the local area. Right. So proximity plays the role in determining, you know, any question that you have. So if you have doubts as to whether it came from a different orchard, which is not Arla, if it came from this orchard, you found it here, you assume it came from here. Sharia Ravina. Ravina said, you're allowed to drink this wine, meaning it's not Arla. It didn't come.
If it's lying on the ground next to the vine that's Arla, I would assume that the grapes are likely Arla.
Correct.
You're talking about wine that came from grapes that somebody worked on and put it into a bottle and brought the bottle. You know, maybe he brought the bottle because, you know, we couldn't eat from the local produce.
So the Gemara is going to use a slightly different Svara, but let's go through the Shaklavitari of the Gemara. The Gemara says, Lema Mishum de Savarle Kiravina. Kirabi Chanina, excuse me. Why don't we assume that Ravina embraces the Shita Rabbi Chanina? And what beats out Karov? Rov. Most of the orchards anywhere in proximity are no longer Arla, and therefore the wine is mutter. Instead of assuming that this wine was produced locally in this orchard where you found it, we're going to assume that the wine was transported from another vineyard, which was not Arla, because the majority of the vines around are not Arla, and it was transported into this particular orchard. Therefore, what we have here is a construct in which Rov collides with Karov, and when we have to determine which overrides which, we employ the approach of Rabbi Chanina, that Rov beats out Karov, and therefore you're allowed to drink the wine. So again, we see another attempt, and the Gemara is very, shall I say, consistent, at trying to prove that Rabbi Chanina is correct and Rov beats out Karov. So Gemara says, no, you have no proof. Shiny Hassam, this case is different. And the reason why Karov beats out Rov, the reason why Rov beats out Karov is because this case of Karov, the proximity doesn't prove anything. Now, at this point, as we read this Gemara, you should keep in mind that the Gemara works with a certain premise. I'm not 100% sure I understand the reality, the logistics of this premise. But the Gemara assumes that when you find something hidden, then it's stolen goods. What do I mean by stolen goods? The thief didn't have a chance to transport his goods, so he hides it in a place so that when he has chance, he'll go back and retrieve it. Says the Gemara, Shiny Hasam, De'i Mignav Minei, Atznui Begavei Lo Mitzni. It is not the way of a ganov. Latznui means to hide something locally, meaning in the very same orchard that he stole it from. In other words, if this guy came in and he stole the grapes and made the wine or whatever he did, he would not hide it in that particular location. Now, although Karov maybe does beat out Rov as a general rule, here Karov, the proximity, tells me nothing. Because we have a counter logic, counter svara to say that this wine came from a different vineyard, not from the local one. Rashi says the following. You'll count up from the bottom of the page, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines. Ein derech haganovim latznia to hide yayin b'makom shegonvu misham. They don't hide it in the same place that they stole it. Why not? Mishum de misyore, the ganav is afraid, shema yimtzu derech haganovim. In other words, every vineyard is owned by someone, and that someone employs the Darchei Hanovim. These are people who, I don't know if you've ever seen this, if you visit some of the vineyards up in the north, in the Golan, and I'm sure so in Canada as well, you'll see how they take the grapes and they crush it. In the old days, they used to crush it by foot. They used to actually stomp on it. I don't know if you've ever seen that. If you go up to the Golan, you could actually, they'll give you a demonstration about, you know, they come out in the biblical clothes, you know, of that time, and they'll even invite you to take off your socks and join the fun. It's very therapeutic. In any event, the Dorchei Hanovim get a good view of the grapes on the ground. They will notice this flask of wine, and they will retrieve it and either pocket it, or maybe assume it came from, it belongs to the master, the owner of the vineyard, and they'll return it to him. Lo and behold, the ganav comes back to look for his wine, his grape juice, and he can't find it. So therefore, we assume that the flask of wine that was found here came from elsewhere. It couldn't have come from here, because the ganav wouldn't have hidden it here. He would take it and transport it to a different place and hide it there. So wherever you found it, you know for sure it came from somewhere else. by possible elimination.
Was there anything in the statement of the scenario that the wine was hidden and found rather than just being there in the open?
No, the word matzniyeh. Latznia means to hide.
Yeah, but that's in this statement.
Oh, you're talking in other sugyas in Shas, you mean?
No, no. If you go back a few lines. Yeah. When this scenario was first proposed, is there something that suggested that this flask was hidden in the vineyard that's Orla?
I don't know. I'm not sure what the answer to your question is. But the Gemara assumes that it was hidden there. Now, it could be that the Gemara assumes it was hidden there because otherwise we'll be forced to assume that Ravina was relying on Rav Chanina. And in order to break that contingency or that connection and offer the possibility that Ravina is not based on Rabbi Chanina, in other words, to invalidate the Karov, we're going to assume that a hidden flask is not hidden locally, it's not from the local produce, but rather comes and is transported from elsewhere.
Yeah, but in this sentence, it talks about that it was a hidden flask, and we were saying, well, but if it's hidden, that would imply that it's not hidden from produce of that location.
Right.
It would have been hidden from produce from somewhere else, but the original statement.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you, that the original statement was made by Ravina, and offhand, the only way of making sense out of Ravina would be to link it up with Rabbi Chanina. But the Gemara wants to break that connection, and therefore suggests this Svara that it came from elsewhere, and therefore, what Ravina's saying really is that that there's no Karov over here, meaning Karov is meaningless, it tells me nothing.
But you can't prove it actually from the text.
I don't know. You might be right about that. I simply don't know. I got to plead the fifth on that. But the next line in the Gemara is very critical. And the Gemara says, Vahani mili, but this entire halacha, which is predicated on the assumption that the wine was imported from another vineyard, that's only chamra. That only applies if you found wine. Aval envy, but if you found a cluster of grapes that was hidden, let's say it was bagged or something, matzni, then indeed the ganav would have hidden locally his grapes, the stolen grapes. And Rashi explains why. Rashi says, no, actually Rashi doesn't say anything. Does Tosa say anything? Let's see. Lema mishum de sovelek rabbi chanina velekla meimer de sharia mishum sofek orla b'chutzlaritz the suffix Arla B'chutzlatz Muteres. Okay, Tosis is asking actually a different question. Let's just see this Tosis for a minute. This is a fascinating Tosis. He says, why does the Gemara assume in its initial stage that Ravina is based on Rov? Maybe in Ravina's mind, Rov and Karov sort of equalize each other. They're equal forces. And what we're left with, therefore, is a suffix. Now, presumably, this scenario, this case, came up in Chutz Laaretz, in Bavel. And in Bavel, as part of Chutz Laaretz, we have a different principle regarding Arla. Normally, in all Isurim, we say suffix Isur L'chumra. Here, in the case of Arlas Chutz Laaretz, the rule is that suffix Mutar. We don't go l'chumra, but rather l'kula. So how does the Gemara know that when Ravina allowed you to drink the wine, he was basing himself on Rov, like Rabbi Chanina, which beats out Karov? Maybe Rov and Karov, when they're in collision, generates a suffix. excuse me. And once you have a safek, if we're dealing with Orlas Chutzlaretz, then safek mutter. Do ha'islei, do ha'i leslei kirabi chanina el rov v'karv haslina basakarv v'kein avi vadei orl. In order to answer this question and understand what the Gemara was thinking, Tosa sets up a very, very sharp and powerful premise or principle, and that is that if Karov beats out Rov, then it becomes Vade Orla. If Karov beats out Rov, it's not that we don't know what to do, and therefore we're in a suffix situation, but Karov would beat out Rov and set up Vadai Orla. Completely negate and decimate the Rov. That's the power of Karov. So therefore, how could Ravina allow you to drink this wine unless he held like Rabbi Chanina that Rov defeats Karov? It would be impossible for him to permit us to drink this wine, because the flip side would be, if we reject Rabbi Chanina, if Ravina would reject Rabbi Chanina, we'd have a situation in which Karov completely decimates Rov, and therefore we're left with Vade Arla. In other words, Tosus is excluding the middle case. He's not willing to say that the possibility exists that Rov and Karov leads to a dead alley, to a dead end, and it's a suffix. You have two choices, and only two choices. Either Karov beats out Rov, and then you get a Vade in that direction, or vice versa, Rov beats out Karov, and you get a Vade based on the Rov. There's no room, says Tosus, for the middle of the road. Now, take a look at the next Tosus. This is also a very important Tosus. Tosus says, Vatznu'ui begavei, v'im tomar, mikol makom yeh osur, Deruba di alma nachrin ninhu, vavi yayin nesach. He says, even if you'll apply the principle of Rov, that doesn't justify Ravina. You're going to say it didn't come from this vineyard locally, which is Arla. It came from other vineyards, which are not Arla. That's fine, but the only problem is, most of the vines are owned by Goyim. And therefore, Ruba di alma, if we're going with Rav Chanina, would tell me that the yayin is yayin nesach? That's a fascinating question. Now, before we see Tosa's answer to that question, I want to show you the next Gemara. And the Gemara tells us, Hani, Hanu Ziki the Chamre, you found flasks of wine. Dishtakhan, where did you find them? Beik Hupai, they were hidden amongst the vines in a vineyard, and the vineyard was owned by Yisrael. Sharinu Rava. In other words, Rava assumed that it came and it belongs to this Jewish vine, Jewish vineyard, and therefore you're allowed to drink the wine. What about the Rove? Most of the wine is not Jewish. Lema lo savrala k'Rabbi Chanina. Should we now assume that Rava rejects Rabbi Chanina and prefers Karov over Rov? And Tosus points out on the bottom line, that's a problem, because Rava isle liel the Rabbi Chanina. It was Rava himself who proved Rabbi Chanina based on the brisa of Dam HaNimtza B'Prozdor. On my Rava, I'm just quoting the Gemara above, Shma Mino Rabbi Chanina Tlas, Shma Mino Rova Karov Halach Achar Rov. So since Rav himself is committed to accept the principle of Rav Chanina that Rov beats out Karov, how can he allow you to drink this wine because it was located in a Jewish vineyard when the Rov tells me it came from non-Jewish sources? And the Gemara answers, Shani Hasam Deruba Deshfuchai, and here we turn to Amid Beis, Yisrael Ninhu. Now, Rashi explains what this shifuchai is. Shifuchai are the larger barrels of wine that are used for commerce and are sold. It's not smaller volumes of wine which are put into bottles and are used on the table. Certainly, excuse me, if you find a smaller volume of wine in a smaller flask, you would have to assume, based on Rove, that it didn't come locally from the Jewish owner of the vineyard, but it came from the Ruba the Alma and Rove beats Hakaro. But here, you found it in a large container called a chavit, a barrel. And Rashi explains on the top line, Shofche yayin min hachavit linodot limkar li ovrei drachim b'medina zos. And what happens is the Jewish people will pour from these large barrels that store great volumes of wine. They'll transfer it over to the smaller flasks. Says the Gemara, Hani Mili Beravrave. So if you have a very heavy barrel, and from that heavy barrel you pour a substantial volume of wine into a large flask, and it's very heavy, that's called Ravrave. Says Rashi, the Lekala Mechash Leruba the Alma, Lememar Meovei Drachim Nafal, right, those who are passing through this area are likely to be non-Jews, but they wouldn't have dropped and left behind such a heavy volume of wine. That's called Ravrave. Abel Zutri, but if you find a smaller volume of wine, Amor, we should suggest, may Ovrei Drachim Nafal. Maybe it was actually dropped from one of the passers-by, and it came from outside of the vineyard, and therefore Rove would beat out Karov. And rather than attribute this wine to the local wine owner, in this case the Jew, we're going to assume that the wine came from the Ruba the Alma of the Ovrei Drachim, which are non-Jews, because you found the smaller volume. So again, the larger volumes would not have been left behind by the Ovrei Drachim. So we knock off the Ruba the Alma. What we're left with is Karov. But Rava accepts Rabbi Chanina that when the Rove is valid and applies, the Rove beats out the Karov. So in this case of Zutri, where you found it from in a smaller volume, which is lighter, and it's very possible that, you know, from all the different flasks of wine that he was carrying as he was going, or fell out of his wagon, and therefore it may have come from the Ovrei Drachim, we're going to activate the Ruba the Alma, which is in this case non-Jews, and the wine is prohibited. However, v'ika ravrave bahadayu, emor, we should say bavrure havimanchi. Rashi says v'ika ravrave bahadayu, three lines down from the top, afaktanim mutarim. Debiravrave lav urchayu di ovrei drachim elakulu milokeach yayin shel medina zuninu v'yisroel heim uktanim she'ein derech lalokeach yayin le'avim. In other words, if you find both the larger barrels and a smaller flask together, then you assume that they came together. And since they came together, even though you found wine not only in the larger container, the barrel, but you also found it in the smaller container, once we assume they came together, so since the Ravrave did not come from the Ovrei Drachim, even the smaller volumes of wine did not come from the Ovrei Drachim. And that's what Rashi says here. Emor ba'avrure haviman chila hashvos masa chamor. Why did he carry a number of smaller nodos, flasks of wine? He says because he needed something to balance the weight on the beast of burden who was carrying the wine. And therefore, kishayesh tei nodos, ze gadol mizeh me'at, if one is larger than the other, machbid hamasa letzad echad, it shifts, it tilts the weight to one side. So what does he do to correct that situation? Menicham nod katan, etzlo lahashvos hamasa. So in other words, you have one large barrel that tilts in one side, and the animal is having a lot of trouble with that, you know, you can't walk normally, so you balance the weight by adding smaller volumes of wine on the other side. And the bottom line here is that since you found both the larger barrel and the smaller barrel, you assume that they both came from the same source. And as we said before, the large barrel didn't come from the Ovidrachim, but rather it came locally, and therefore we assume it came from a Jewish source, namely the owner of the vineyard. So we can reconcile, just to summarize, Rava with Rabbi Hanina. Rava indeed accepts Rabbi Hanina as a general rule that Rav beats out Karo, but in this case, where you have Simanim Uvhakim, you have reason to believe that it came locally because it couldn't have come from the Ovidrachim, you found such a large barrel, therefore the Rav is completely detonated, it's completely neutralized, and you're left with Karo.